His Holiness has a cold, so he doesn't want to give it to us. So, you know, we were talking about self yesterday. And we were also talking about body self. So today the body self is a little ill.
So, good morning, Your Holiness. This is our last day in this meeting. And we're so grateful, again, to be here at Sarah Monastery and with you. And we've been exploring the field of the sense fields of perception, moving into concept formation, and then into the formation of a sense of self. And with this presentation this morning with your student, Mathieu Ricard, we want to move the subject forward of self into the transformation from a reified self into an unlimited self. And Mathieu, as you know, is a person who is a scientist and contemplative, many, many years in the Himalayas, author, photographer, and he's best known for being a great humanitarian. So, Mathieu.
Thank you. So, Your Holiness, if great scholars like Geshe Thapki and Thubten Jimbala and Jay and John feel difficult to speak in your presence, I should be a thousand times more embarrassed, not having any formal training. But today, fortunately, I don't have to present a specific Buddhist position except for an introduction. More try to enlarge the debate to see how we can work together to create a better world in the vision of fundamental human values, secular ethics based on science. And so what I'm going to share and offer to you here is not about a perception or about concept or about the self as such, but what are the consequences of viewing the self in certain ways. And we might think, well, no, what does it matter to think of I have a unitary, independent self when the planet is burning? You know, who cares? not a big deal. But in fact, it's a little bit like saying, what do I care for the spark when the forest is in fire? But the fire started with a spark, and then the spark fell on dry grass and the whole forest got in fire. So what I want to show, for instance, is from the perspective of a very strong, unitary, sort of strong concept of a solid self, then comes a vision of the world, of others, that is based on a more self-centered attitude. And just to give the example of the environment, it's a complex issue politically, economically, and scientifically. Although there's a consensus about what's going on, but the way it's going to happen, is it going to be a huge catastrophe or maybe a little bit less? It's complex. But in the end, it is an opposition between selfishness and altruism. Because none of us will be here in 150 years. For me, it's just maybe 10 if I'm lucky. So if we don't care, so if we don't care for future generation, if we have no consideration for them, there's nothing to worry about the environment. So someone said, why should I care for future generation? What did they do for me? So if you take this selfish attitude, no problem. So I want to show how, in fact, this strong perception of self leads to that. So it has been, the idea of the self has been expounded in great details and with a wonderfully articulate and clear view by all the scholars that preceded me. But just to recap the process of going from a certain perception of the self to a selfish attitude in the world towards others, including other species. So first, as Your Holiness often says, we have this I moment to moment. I'm hungry, I'm cold, I exist. So that's, of course, that's natural. There's no problem with that. That's how we can function in the world. And as we said earlier, we also have this notion of a person, the kangsa. And that's the whole dynamic stream of consciousness, that continuum of consciousness that carries all the imprints from the past, whether it's this life or in the Buddhist perspective from many lifetimes. There is a moment to moment, but there is a continuum, and that continuum is different from an individual to another, in the same way that the Ganges is not the same as the Mississippi River, although there's no Ganges entity. And then there is the self as a construct, as a concept, that we believe is unitary, is sort of constant. As you said yesterday, we feel that this little boy I was, I'm still the same guy, and that sort of keeps my unity. And we believe it is some kind of intrinsic existence. It has to exist somehow, and some people even come to think this is like the core, the most essence of my being. So if we have this, the stronger we have this perception, then from there we'll arrive a strong feeling of self-centeredness. Everything revolves around me. I'm sort of the center of the world. I think once you said, we feel that, you know, a certain country, and maybe France, is the center of the world, and within France is Paris, and within Paris it's me. So this kind of perception we have. Then there is the self-cherishing. I always try to please the self and to get rid of what threatens the self. So attraction, repulsion. From there comes what is known in Buddhism as the five main mental poisons or toxins, like hatred, desire, attachment, ignorance in the sense of lack of discernment. What is going to bring happiness? What's going to bring suffering? Or pride or arrogance, jealousy. All that will bring to suffering. So basically, we could say that roughly, these are embodied in one thing, selfishness. Me, 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 all day long. So what are the... But if we really look at that, and that's, I'm not going to come back on this, if we do a total investigation, and we see that with the concept of the self, we attach it to a constantly changing stream of consciousness. It's always changing. And then to multiple, impermanent, interdependent physical aggregate. This was said yesterday. There's no need to come back on this. Now, if we understand the interdependence between all phenomena, naturally, this brings an increased consideration for others. I don't want to suffer. I don't wake up in the morning thinking, may I suffer the whole day? So it's easy to see that any sentient beings doesn't want to suffer. And the interrelatedness makes us feel, I care for my suffering. Why should I not care for others' suffering? So altruism, or xianpen, is the wish that others may find happiness and the cause of happiness. Now, of course, many beings suffer. Therefore, when meeting with suffering, altruism becomes compassion. The wish may be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Now, some people might say it's easy to pursue a kind of selfish happiness. I'm only care of me. That's an easier task. I don't mind if others are happy, but it's not my job. So that perception of being in my little cocoon and it's easier to make my happiness, basically it fails. It fails because thinking me, me, me all day long is not a very happy state of mind. It makes yourself miserable, and of course you make others miserable because you are very selfish. And also it doesn't work, because it's supposed that you could be this isolated entity, and since this is not the case, it's going to be dysfunctional. It's not going to work. If you think of the opposite, having consideration for others, altruism and compassion, it leads to a win-win situation. In a way, kindness, generosity, loving kindness, those are the most satisfying states of mind. And also, of course, others will be pleased by your way of behavior. And on top of that, it's going to work, because this is attuned to interdependent reality. So therefore, it will work. So now that's a kind of more on a personal level. But can we take that to a more global level? Like I mentioned that the question of the environment, in the end, it is somehow altruism versus selfishness. So what are the consequences? So sometime in the West especially, and or many other modern sort of cultures, altruism is seen as some kind of naive, somehow utopian, not very realistic ideal. So it cannot work with the economy, for instance, or with politics. But in fact, if you want to build a better world, we are facing challenges in the short term, the economy. Oh, if the economy doesn't go well, nothing can go well. So first priority, short term. But then there's quality of life. If a country is the most powerful and the richest, and everyone is miserable, unhappy, what's the point? And then, long term, the caring, the fate of future generation. Now, that's something very new for humanity. 10,000 years ago, there was about 5 million human beings on Earth. It's almost nothing. So they are only tools that they use with their hands. Now we have 7 billion. Tools, power is multiplied by million times, think of atomic energy. They are not in the hands of people, but of groups and nations. So for the first time, we are the major actor on the fate of future generation. We have this incredible power to do a lot of good and a lot of harm. And that took us by surprise, because it came slowly through the scientific and technological revolution, and nobody waked up in the morning thinking, I'm going to, you know, damage the world. So we don't feel responsible, because it's a global phenomenon. So if economists speak with people, scientists of the environment, they don't speak the same language. One is speaking a few months, other one is speaking 50 or 100 years. So we need one concept. At least we can talk together on those short-term, mid-term, long-term to build a better world. The only concept that works is having more consideration for others. Then we can build up something together. So in the short term, that will link to a more caring economics, where economy is at the service of society and not society at the service of economics. In the midterm, is reducing inequalities, supporting social justice, and favoring the pursuit of happiness. In the long term, is caring for future generation, other species, and the environment. Now, yes, we do feel many challenges. This can be in our own life. You know, at the personal level, our mind can be sometimes our best friend. I'm sure in the case of my first teacher, Kanju Rinpoche, you know, someone who whose mind was completely free from those sort of inner mental toxins. But our mind can also be our worst enemy. And we know now that within a few years, depression and other related mental illnesses will be the major factor for the numbers of days in our life that we cannot function properly. It has become a major problem. Now, if you go beyond the individual, in all the 36 most richest countries, inequalities have been growing for the last 30 years. So you have poverty in the midst of plenty. And that is keep on growing in all the 36 OECD countries. So that is something that comes from lack of care, and that affects people over a very long time. Then, even further and more global issue, we know some people still consider our planet as if it was could provide unlimited resources. But the way we use the natural resources today, if we continue with that increased speed, we would need 3 or 5 planets by 2050. We don't have them. So we are somehow at the edge of a cliff or a precipice. There are possible tipping points, irreversible phenomena that can happen. So if we say, just let's continue like that, it's like this head of state who once said, 5 years ago, we were at the edge of the precipice, now we made a big step forward. So if you make a big step forward here, you are in deep trouble. So if you picture this edge here of the precipice, a few years ago we had a meeting on environment, and Diana Liverman presented the work of Johan Rockström about the planetary boundaries. So you see this line. So there's a number of factors, I'm not going to talk about them, but if we could remain, all those factors, the carbon dioxide, the acidification of the ocean, if we could remain within certain limits, then humanity could continue to prosper for another 50,000 years with a stable climate. So in 1900, from what we can know, almost everything was within those limits of safety. 1950 comes what is called the great acceleration. Things go starting getting hot, literally. Now, if we can hold our breath, not too long, but to imagine what it is now, we have vastly gone over the planetary boundaries. To give one example here, loss of biodiversity. At the current speed of losing species today, if we extrapolate for 2050, a third, 30% of all species on Earth will have disappeared forever. The last major extinction, that of the dinosaurs and many of them, that's very long ago. That was the fifth one since life exists on Earth. So we are heading almost now, it seems, irremediably to the sixth one. And it's not going to stop by 2050. So that's something that is not just sort of theoretical. It is due to this great acceleration of carbon dioxide. There's anything you can look at, use of fresh water, forest, deforestation, is all increasing like this sharply. There's one thing that might interest you, is the same thing with methane. In the Tibetan plateau, there's one third of all the permafrost in the world. Permafrost is that layer of earth that is frozen. This permafrost contains a huge amount of methane. Now, if methane is released, methane is 20 times more active for greenhouse gas effect than CO2. So that's one huge danger. The other cause of release of methane is industrial farming, the production of meat, from deforestation to carrying the grain to rich country, the methane from the cows and the pigs and so forth. This is not just a small thing. after the housings, this is the second cause of greenhouse gas effect. 14% before transportation, before the cars, the house, the ships, the planes. This is a major problem due to a vast increase for the demand of meat consumption. That may seem the discourse of a fanatic vegetarian, but this is according to the report of United Nations on climate change. If you see the USA, 120 kilos of meat per year per inhabitant, only 3 in India, about 5 in Africa, 80 in Europe. That is a very typical example of selfishness. We think that because we are so smart and crafty and clever and powerful, that the whole world and other species can be just instruments in our hands. So we kill 60 billion land animals every year, 1,000 billion sea animals every year. We just treat them as instrument, objects. That shows to where selfishness can lead. And this comes originally from the spark of a very strong, verified self. So this is going on and on in the industrial scale, but also so-called for hunting for pleasure, pleasure to kill. Or because we want to wear the fur of animals, we neglect and don't see the intense suffering that we cause. Because we believe that bear bile has some medical property that was, of course, never proven by science, we keep thousands of bears in cages for years and years and years. So, this is kind of the situation. So, what can we do? We can sit in front of the glacier and look at them melting, or pray to God, as you said, maybe not solve human-made problem. There are several thousand glaciers in the Himalayas. They are all melting faster than the North and the South Pole because they absorb dust and the snow melt fast, the third pole. So, after all, why? Some people have thought that because we are fundamentally selfish and there's nothing we can do about that. So let's examine this idea. There are many philosophers, I'm not going to quote them. I'll just quote one who is not a philosopher but a self-styled psychologist, Sigmund Freud. He said, "I've discovered very little good in humans. From what I know, most of them are rascals." Rascals means like marap. So they are just everyone, most of them are terrible people. So that was the view of the founder of psychoanalysis. So it's a good start. So is that true? Obviously, that fly in the face of our experience. But some people took that even further. There is a philosopher that is very little known in Europe. They think she's crazy, but very, very influential in the United States. You cannot understand the Tea Party and the very sort of super right without Ayn Rand, who basically said, "I consider altruism as evil." She said, if you say you should be altruistic, you are sacrificing yourself, you're losing your dignity, that is bad. But you think that lady is crazy. The problem is that she's extremely influential and it's hard to understand without knowing what she says. So is it true? Fortunately, there's also great philosophers in the West who said this is silly to say that every of our motive is selfish. So David Hume said the most obvious objection to the selfish hypothesis is to the most candid observer. They appear to be such disposition as benevolence, generosity, love, friendship, compassion, gratitude. That's a fact of daily life. In fact, we could say that most of the time, most of 7 billion beings behave decently with each other. Of course, what attracts our attention is sometimes, always, somewhere, there's something terrible happening. Here we are sitting peacefully, but if two people start fighting in a little corner, everybody will look just at that. So because of that, we forget the banality of goodness. Goodness is much more prevailing. Cooperation, for instance, is all over the place. People love cooperate. They enjoy cooperate. And not only in humans. Now, of course, people have said yes, but there is the struggle for life. There is winners and losers, competition. The thing is that, of course, competition exists. But if you look at recent work in evolution, like the work of Martin Novak in Harvard, they have been shown that cooperation was the much more important factor throughout evolution to getting to increased level of complexity. Of course, we can struggle to survive, but we can struggle together instead of against each other. So I think the notion of competition certainly seems to have been overrated in evolution, and cooperation is, in fact, much more crucial. We also know that in big surveys, when you ask people what is the factor that contributes most to your well-being, income, of course, is important, but it comes about number 5. There was a huge survey in the 36 richest countries. Number 1, quality of human relationship. So that it is known that you have a rich social support, people you can trust, people you can ask for advice when things are difficult for you. If you have this, it increases your better health, longevity, less addiction problems, and so forth, and so forth. And of course, it didn't come out of the blue. This also, as social animals, we are not the only one. There had been an interesting study with some areas of the world where there are a lot of people over 100 years old. Those are two Japanese sisters. It was found when studying those places, the main characteristics is that people have a very strong social bonding. They are born, they live, and they die together, they rejoice together. When there are problems, they are together. That seems to be the main factor. So now, you might say, of course, it's nice to say that altruism exists, that cooperation is important. But still, some psychologists, some economists say, well, even you do something good to others, if you're really smart and look inside, you will find a selfish motivation. They say, scratch at the surface of an altruist and the selfish will bleed. So, in some cases, it is true. I mean, Zonnes often says about what is a violent act. It could be you praise someone, you make some presents to someone, but actually you want to cheat that person. So it looks good, but it's some violence in it. So it looks you're doing something good, but it's selfish. Or you might do it so that people praise you or to feel good about yourself. But is that true in any cases? So, for instance, some people say, oh, he did a big donation anonymously. So nobody's going to praise that person. But he tells to a friend, I felt so good about that. So someone will come and say, oh, look, you didn't do for the others. You did because you feel good. So is that always the case? So look at this little movie. There's somebody falling on the track of the subway, and another guy jumps and takes it off. And here too, all right. So this person, when he does that, is not going to think, I'm going to feel so good when this is finished. Now, that's not the end. Journalists will come and ask the person, how did you do that? He said, of course I had to do that. I had no choice. How could I not save that person? So the smart psychologist comes, and not all of them, of course, and say, aha, you have no choice. It's instinctive behavior. Automatically, it's not really altruism. So I discussed that with many of my friends, including Daniel Batson. He said, of course there's a choice, but the choice is so fast because it's obvious to you. This person has a choice, but is not going to think for half an hour, should I give my hand or not give my hand? The choice is obvious. So there is a choice, but it is clear. This animal has a choice, very clear choice, and is still holding firm. He could let go. Now, there are people in the world who did extraordinarily altruistic deeds and had a choice. This is a couple of a pastor, Protestant pastor, in France during the Second World War, near Switzerland. With a whole village, for 4 years, they saved 3,500 Jewish persons. They hide them in their house, they hide them in the forest. Themselves, their family, the whole village were under constant threat to be sent to the concentration camp. They never closed their door to anyone asking for help. So this is over a long time. So someone like Daniel Batson, whom you met in Zurich when we did a Mind and Life, he has shown over 30 years, and I, of course, cannot go in detail, with many sort of smart experiments in the lab, if you put people in all kinds of situations, there's always a significant number of people who will choose to behave altruistically, even they have an easy excuse or escape not to do so. So people will go out of their way to behave in an altruistic manner. So this is kind of obvious. We have empathy. Here's a Chinese person who lost his leg when he was 5 years old, and then he has been helping others all his life. So we see images of suffering, and we feel a strong empathy. Empathy is not the same as altruism. Empathy is the affective resonance. I see someone smiling, I smile. I see someone suffering, I suffer because of the suffering of the person. Now, if you only have empathy and you are exposed to suffering again and again and again, you will have burnout. 60% of all medical personnel in the United States have suffered or will suffer of these emotional exhaustions that we call empathic distress. Now, the work that Tanya Singer is doing and others are doing is showing that altruistic love and compassion actually is the antidote to empathic distress, because empathic distress is a sort of negative emotion. It's a burden. It decreases your courage. What, as is your Holiness often said, compassion brings compassionate courage, strength, determination. It's a positive mental state. So Tanya could show that if you practice compassion, it is actually the remedy to burnout. And then we know that doctors were extremely kind and their patients also feel well treated. So let's assume that, of course, selfishness exists, nobody doubts that, but that also genuine altruism does exist. So now, the world is what it is. Definitely we'll be better off if we could increase altruism in ourselves and in society. So we need individual change and societal change. So is individual change possible? So I think here I don't need to convince anyone, because we have 2,500 years of the Buddhist path that is meant to become a better person and, if possible, achieve enlightenment, but at least become a better person, do good, and if not, at least do not cause harm. And we are with eminent scientists who know that we can change because of plasticity of the brain and mental training bring some change. So Yet, it was not obvious 15 years ago, when, thanks to the initiative of Mind and Life and meeting with everyone, many people here, it was decided to embark in this study of the possibility of mind training changing the brain. So we didn't recruit great masters like Kanyu Rinpoche, but like Kensi Rinpoche, but we asked students of those great teachers in the beginning who had been spending a lot of time in very quiet places like here, where there's nothing much else to do than meditate. You don't have many supermarkets and movies there. And thanks also to Francisco Varela and others, and Richie here, and so many others, we could begin this study of long-term meditators first through electroencephalogram and MRI, and very soon it appeared, I'm not going to go in detail, but if you compare, this is about compassion meditation. Down you see untrained people, when they try to generate compassion, nothing much happened. On the top, you see long-term meditators, when they engage in compassion meditation, you have this very high peak, that blue line, that shows very strong activation in the brain. If you look at brain imagery on the left, you have the long-term practitioners at rest, a little bit of blue. B, when they engage in compassion meditation, some areas of the brain are strongly activated. On the right, if you take novices who have not done much training, there's no difference at rest, and when they try to engender compassion, nothing much happens. Now, this gives the idea that we can change individually. But do we have this kind of predisposition? So this is where the study with young infants that you mentioned yesterday comes. And I will show you a little movie from the lab that precisely have shown that evidence with 1 year old and sometimes 3 years old. So what they do, we don't see very clearly here, but they have these puppets. One is helping each other, the other one. One is not helping. And you have a very, very young child watching those puppets. And then one is helping, one is not helping, creating obstacles. At the end, the experimenter will show the one-year-old baby the two puppets, the nice one and the nasty one, and we'll see which one the young infant choose. So you can look at this. So he's trying to open the box. He cannot open the box. The little baby looks at that. Then comes the nice one who is helping. So now he will try again. Still looking. And then comes the bad puppet who closed the box. Then you show the good one, the blue one, and the yellow one that is the bad one. And see who the baby will take. Well, the baby takes the nice puppet. Now 95% of 1 year old will choose the nice guy. Now, as I mentioned yesterday, it was done with 3 months old. So, of course, they don't catch, but you can follow their gaze. Where do they look? Again, even with 3 months old babies, 90% look long time towards the nice puppet. So that shows that there's this natural preference. And as social animals, that's understandable. If we're all about fighting against each other, not going to work. Now, Richie also showed that we could train with a kindness curriculum children to change their behavior over 10 weeks. So Richie showed you that in Madison. So you have this 10-week curriculum on generosity, cooperation, gratitude, all that. After 10 weeks, you see a strong increase in pro-social behavior in the children who underwent that intervention compared to others. But then come the ultimate scientific test, the stickers test. So kids love those stickers, you know, the little thing that you paste with difference. So you, before the intervention, you ask to every children, who's their best friend in the class? Who's the child that they cannot stand? And then you give them envelopes with a photo of their best friend, their less favorite child, an unknown child, and a sick child. And you say, no, please, you give those stickers away in the envelope. So before the intervention of 10 weeks, as you can see, they give almost everything to their best friend. So that's why there's division between people. My group, their group, we, they. It's about race, it's about religion, ethnicity, and so forth. So these are 4, 5 years old. It's done in a very playful manner. So maybe you think this won't make much difference, but it does. It's almost, after 10 weeks, they give almost the same number to all of them. There's very little difference. So you stop discriminating between the best friend and this child that you cannot stand in the class. In just 10 weeks. So we try to do that in our schools in Bihar, in India. We have 25,000 children in the school that we built. We do through kindness meditation and so forth. The kids love that. And so it seemed that, yes, individual change is possible. I was also just to show something that is encouraging. You know, sometimes I have the great fortune to be your interpreter for French language. And quite often, at the question time, someone asks, Your Holiness, violence is increasing everywhere in the world. What can we do? So as interpreter, I have to translate the question. But in my mind, I say, no, it's not true, but I cannot tell you that I have to translate the question. But the good news is despite the fact that we see every day on TV and in the news something terrible happening somewhere in the world, over the last 5 centuries, violence has been steadily declining. That's a fact. There's an 800-page book that gathers all the scientific study showing that. The decline of violence in history and its causes. Just one example. Homicides. How many people get killed? In Oxford, in England, in the 14th century, there was 100 homicides per year per 100,000 people. Now it's 100 times less. Throughout Europe, the rate of homicide has decreased from 50 to 100 times. Despite all we see on TV, we never live in a safer place. Domestic abuse, domestic violence, is still one of the biggest forms of violence in the world. No, beating wives, beating children. The United States, over 20 years, the violence towards children, the most serious one, like physical abuse and sexual abuse, has decreased twice. Now, there are many wars, Iraq-Iran wars, Sudan, now what's happening in Syria. Those are terrible dramas. But if you look from 1950, there is 2 big studies looking at all the conflicts throughout the world, everywhere. How many conflicts? How many people died? You divide. After the Second World War, the average numbers of victims per conflict were 50,000. Today is 1,000. Yes, there is ISIS. Yes, there is South Sudan. But globally, there's much less casualty due to war. So that's a fact, despite the idea we have through the media. So now how to go from individual change to societal change? So there's a very interesting branch of evolution that's called cultural evolution. That means that genes change very slowly. We don't have many new genes in human beings for the last 10,000 years. Something about using milk, but that's not a very big deal. But to have a more altruistic gene might take 50,000 years. We don't have time to wait for that. So, fortunately, the evolution of cultures is faster than genes. And that is a serious branch of evolution. Culture can change over one or two generations. Look at the attitudes towards war. In France, at the time of the First World War, in 1914, people from the village, they were going to the war singing. It was wonderful to fight for the nation. The priests were blessing the cannons and the weapons. It was a great enthusiasm. Of course, it was a terrible, terrible things. But still people think that war is the melting pot of civilization, is heroic, is noble. No, hardly anyone except few crazy people think that. This has changed dramatically. Attitudes toward the environment. When I was a young bird watcher and the first few books on ecology came, it was just like people thinking we were like hippies. Now we could see with the Paris Agreement, now it's become a major issue for everyone in the world. So culture changed, and that's the good thing about it. And it has been shown that we could change to a more altruistic society. Some models have been made, and the reasoning is quite simple. Altruistic people like to gather together. They like to work together. They like to cooperate. They enjoy that. Now, if you were to put one-to-one, a very selfish person against a very altruistic person, altruistic person will be nice, he will share the food. So the selfish one will always win. And within no time, all the altruistic people will be wiped out. Now, you take a group of altruistic people who cooperate. Now, if there is not even a group, but a collection of selfish people who don't cooperate, they just want everyone for themselves. So they kick each other's leg all day long. So as a group, the group of altruistic will have an advantage over the selfish people. So there is a very complex models of what we call multi-level selection, individual selection, and group selection. This is a very big debate in science. Nevertheless, it seems very possible that thanks to this aggregation of altruistic people, they could get together and somehow we could go to a more cooperative and altruistic society. In fact, evolution selects traits that are favorable to survival. And today, obviously, the trait that will help most our survival is cooperation, not competition. In a city, for instance, all you want to do is to cooperate. If everyone fights against each other, nothing works, from public transport to anything. So then, as terms of solutions, we need to enhance cooperation. We need to enhance cooperation within corporation, for instance, in the business world. It has been shown that most successful and thriving enterprises are those in which everyone trusts each other rather than checking each other. There's been many success stories of CEOs who said, I trust you, and because people feel trust, they give the best of themselves. Cooperation means working together, exchange, free flow of information, exchanging knowledge, working as teams. It makes a happy place to work, and if you are happy to work, you will somehow achieve a better result. We also need to enhance cooperation in education, not too much of a competitive education, but it has been a lot of trying to bring more cooperation in the schools, like making people, students work by small groups of five with one which is very good, with a few others that are less good, and they help each other. It improves a lot the atmosphere in the class, and it also gives better results. We need some kind of what we could call sustainable harmony. We always speak of sustainable development or sustainable growth, but inevitably, People think of growth as something quantitative, more and more. Sustainable harmony is growing in terms of quality, not of quantity. For now, it means reducing inequalities that gives more harmonious society. For the future, means remaining in harmony with nature so that we don't sort of put in danger the long-term effect of the human activities on the planet. We need a caring economics. There is a few economists who have shown that the selfish economics, and by the way, that's the definition of what people call the economic man, Homo economicus. The only thing that's supposed to move economy is promotion of self-interest, the personal preferences. Of course, that's not what human beings are all about. And that cannot take care of poverty in the midst of plenty. You are not maximizing your personal interest. That cannot also take care of the environment, of what we call common goods, the quality of the air, of the ocean, democracy, the pursuit of science, because that's something you have to step out of just promoting your personal interest. So caring economics is needed, the voice of care along the voice of reason. We need local commitment and universal responsibility. Local commitment means we need to do it ourselves. We need, no matter what others are doing, I will do my part, but not in the individualistic way, having what you often call sense of universal responsibility. We also need to extend altruism and consideration to the other 8.7 million other species. They are not there just to entertain us, to feed us. They are the life on their own. They can make the difference between well-being and suffering. They aspire to live the full span of their life. Why not? What kind of right do we have to deprive them of that? It's no more necessary. It's contributing to global warming. It's contributing to increasing poverty because we use so much resources for meat production that could be used in the poor countries. It's not even good for human health. It has now been shown by the big WHO study that shows people who eat meat regularly, they have a 15% chance increase yearly to die of cancer and cardiovascular disease. So it's good for nobody. So we need to have developed this compassionate courage, and we need to dare altruism. Altruism is not just for small kids. It's the most pragmatic answer to the challenges of our time. So Martin Luther King said, every man or woman, of course, must decide whether he or she will walk in the light of creative altruism or in the darkness of destructive selfishness. So since Pavan inspired us by showing also how to put compassion in action, I wanted to share also some of the things we do, not for just self-promotion or anything else, but to show that this is also a way we can engage in caring for others. So Karuna, as you know, means compassion, so we founded a small organization. Over the years, we completed 180 projects. Today, we are able to treat 120,000 patients every year in 25 clinics in northern India, in Bihar and Jharkhand, in Nepal, and in eastern Tibet. We have, for instance, palliative care units for the dying people. Nepal, as you know, has been affected by two major earthquakes. Many people died. 5,000 schools were destroyed. So now, over the last 3 months, we were able to help 200,000 people in 620 villages. We brought 600 tons of rice, 15,000 tents, and now we are going to continue over 3 years in 12 of the 15 districts to rebuild schools, help people for food security, prevent human trafficking, bringing solar electricity, rainwater collection. We work with Bunker Roy to do that. And we are building school with bamboos. It's very cheap. This school can be built for quite a moderate amount, for 2,000 children in 3 months. Now we build 9 such schools, that's 18,000 children. In Tibet, we built 25 dispensaries for health in nomad areas when there was absolutely nothing. So we can see people come in great numbers. In Zonsa, for instance, we built a large clinic for Tibetan medicine that are dispensing medicine all over eastern Tibet. In Amdo, near your birthplace, we built a school for 800 children that deserve 26 villages. This is the birthplace of Gedin Schöppel, so it was called the Gedin Schöppel School. And now, for the last 10 years, there are 800 children studying, those kids who are not going to school. In many nomad areas, we built about 20 schools, and now there are many children, especially girls, who went to higher education. Some now are university, studying medicine, and others in Xining and Chengdu. And you can see the eagerness that children have to study. Even before the school is finished, they come to see, oh, this is our school, we will be able to study. It's a great happiness. We have a project called Save the Mother and Child. Many, many mothers die when giving birth for very silly reasons. For example, they cut the umbilical cord with a rusted knife, things like that. So we give a training for 5,000 nomads to show that what they should do. And we did a little evaluation in one valley. Over 5 years, it reduced 30% mother and child mortality. So this is the training. And just to give one example, this is a woman, a nomad woman. She was dying of bone TB. She was a widow with a 13-year-old daughter. She was just about to die. We just came out. Chinese authorities said, no, there's no TB around here. Get out. So we insisted, and we managed to save her. And here she is the year after, in good health, with their girl. We built 18 bridges, including on the Yangtze River, the Drichu, 3 big bridges on the Zachu, the Mekong rivers, altogether 18 bridges. We're helping the elderly. This is how they used to live. 1 year later, we made a nice place for them to help. There's also earthquake in Tibet, of course. This was in Yushu in 2010. 8,000 people died. This year, in the near Sechen, at very high altitude, 3,800 meters, we are building an earthquake-resistant school for 300 boarding children. So this is trying to put compassion in action. It's just not to show off, but to share the happiness of being at the service of others. This is our little Karuna girl. In India, also, we have a health center. We go in villages. So just to conclude, there are a few major books that might interest people, that just quote them here, The Age of Empathy of Franz de Waal, about showing how empathy comes within animals very early in evolution. Super Cooperators, that show that cooperation has been very important in evolution, as I mentioned. And then books from two of your students, Thubten Jimbala's book, and another book from a strange French Buddhist monk. And so I spent 5 years trying to research, and Jimbala did the same. And everything is thanks to the inspiration of Your Holiness. So it's the greatest depth of gratitude I can have to my teachers, and particularly you. So I'm filled with joy, no matter when I die, that I had the fortune to meet you, receive your teaching, and be inspired by your presence. Thank you so much.
Yes. So we're going to transition from Mathieu to Richie, but I just want to thank you, Mathieu, so much for not only your work in the field of compassionate action in the Himalayas and the Tibetan Plateau, but also for cooperating and collaborating with scientists in Europe, in the United States, and other parts of the world in really deepening the questions of how we can open this field of contemplative science to an even wider world. And that cooperation, I think, is very much captured in the relationship also between you and Richie. So, Richie. So I think that most everyone in this hall knows Richie Davidson, who is one of the great pioneers in the field of contemplative neuroscience, and also has been engaged for many years with His Holiness and in creating the directions that we have pursued in mind and life. So, Richie, thank you.
Thank you, Roshi Joan, and thank you, Your Holiness. I'm particularly humbled to follow Mathieu Law this morning. Since I met Mathieu, he has been such a deep inspiration, not just for our professional work in the laboratory and our collaboration, but also for my own personal practice, which I feel very deeply grateful for. I also wanted to begin with this photograph of Francisco because I was asked to give a short little commentary to follow Mathieu, particularly from the perspective of contemplative neuroscience. And Francisco is really deserves the credit for being the person to have really created contemplative neuroscience, and I think that he would have just relished in the flourishing of this field and how Mind and Life has been extraordinarily successful in catalyzing a field of contemplative neuroscience. We have in the audience who have participated this week in dialogues with the monastics, a whole generation of young scholars. They all really have flowed from the work of Francisco, who inspired this next generation. What I'd like to do in the short time that I have this morning is to take up the issue of well-being and how it is that when we can loosen our reification of the self, when we can induce plasticity in our perception, in our concepts, how well-being can actually flourish. And I specifically wish to address four constituents of well-being that have been investigated neuroscientifically. The first I call resilience, and I'll say more about each of these in a moment. Resilience we define in a very particular way, which is how quickly or slowly a person recovers from adversity, from a stressful challenge. The second is positive outlook. To what extent can a person remain positive throughout the day? A third is attention, focus, mindfulness. And the fourth is generosity. Each of these has been investigated neuroscientifically, and in this brief talk, I'll just say a few things about what we've learned about each of these from a neuroscientific perspective, in some cases sharing very recent data from our own laboratory, in other cases showcasing the work of other scientists. When we speak of resilience, we can think of a person who At time point three, there may be some challenge that occurs in the environment, some stress that occurs, and I've drawn a time course of the response of a person, and we can compare that to a second person who responds at the same amplitude but who recovers more quickly. And this could be in any number of different physiological systems. We can show this kind of time course in many different physiological systems, but we've been particularly interested in studying this in the brain, which is where we think that much of the control of this kind of resilience or recovery may be occurring. And so we've studied this in a structure in the brain, which is illustrated in the top left, and the colored areas represent a particular sector of the human amygdala. Your Holiness has heard about the amygdala in the past, and this is an area of the brain which is very importantly involved in emotion, and particularly it's involved in certain kinds of responses to suffering. And what we see down below in the left at the bottom is the time courses of the amygdala response to images of suffering in individuals who rate themselves as highly neurotic and other individuals who rate themselves as very low in this trait. And this is basically anxiety. And what it shows is that the individuals who rate themselves as low in anxiety are showing more rapid recovery. They are showing increased resilience. So they don't differ in the amplitude of the response. They differ exclusively in this period during the recovery, how rapidly they recover. So, Your Holiness, we've asked the question, how plastic is this? Can this be something that it can actually be trained through mind training? And the answer is that it can. But when we initially did this, we were a little surprised. Here are the time courses from the identical experiment done in 60 non-meditating practitioners, and MNPs stand for meditation-naive participants, and LTM stands for long-term meditators. These are individuals who have an average of about 7,000 hours of lifetime practice. These are not our very experienced practitioners. These are all people who are living in North America, who have day jobs, but who have a meditation practice of at least 10 years. However, so there's no difference between these groups. However, when we divide these groups into the very long-term practitioners, those who have more hours of practice, and those who have less hours of practice. So the ones who have more hours of practice have between roughly 10,000 hours and 32,000 hours of lifetime practice. There we see a large difference during this period of recovery, where the long-term meditators are showing more rapid recovery compared to those who've had just a minimal amount of practice. So this suggests that we can influence this mechanism of resilience in the brain, but only through longer-term practice. That's interesting. And what we see on the left, on the right here, is just a plot that shows the relation between the number of lifetime hours of practice and this parameter of resilience or recovery. And it shows that the more hours of practice you have across the lifetime, the less the amygdala response during the recovery period, which means faster recovery. Okay, I'd like to move on now to the second characteristic of well-being, which has been studied, which is related to this quality of positive outlook. One of the ways I think about positive outlook is the extent to which a person, when they look at another human being, can see their innate basic goodness and can rejoice in the small acts of kindness, who sees the world in a more positive light. And there's a variety of evidence that relates to this characteristic, and we first actually glean some insight about this by looking at patients with depression who suffer from an inability to or a difficulty in having this kind of positive outlook, and looked at differences in their brains. And then we moved on to look at the extent to which this may be related to well-being. And in a study with a large group of individuals, what we have found is that the extent to which a person shows sustained activity in a specific area of the brain that we call the ventral striatum, which is an area that's been associated with positive emotion, the more sustained activation a person shows in this region in response to positive incentives, to stimuli that depict warm-hearted relationships, for example, mothers caressing their baby infants, people report on a standard psychological measure of well-being, they report higher levels of well-being. So what are some of the items on this kind of measure that reflect well-being? So just to give you a more specific feel, individuals who say, when I look at the story of my life, I am pleased with how things have turned out. So someone who endorses that item would be a person with higher levels of well-being. I have confidence in my opinions, even if they are contrary to the general consensus. For me, life has been a continuous process of learning, changing, and growth. People would describe me as a giving person, willing to share my time with others. Some people wander aimlessly through life, but I am not one of them. And finally, and this is scored in the reverse way, in many ways I feel disappointed about the achievements in my life, so that would be scored in the opposite way. But these are all items which are indicative of well-being. This is the most commonly used scale of well-being in Western psychological research. This was devised by a woman named Carol Riff, and the National Institute on Aging is using this in studies that involve hundreds of thousands of individuals all over the world. So, the very same measure the very same measure of the brain that we showed you earlier, which is on the left in the ventral striatum, is also related to the stress hormone, the most important stress hormone in the body, which is cortisol. And what we see is that people who have more activation in this area of the brain, who also show higher levels of well-being, show lower levels of this stress hormone cortisol, which we know is important. It's something we can't do without, but if it lingers, if it's persistent, if it shows sustained activity over time, that's something that can be deleterious. It can be, it can have negative health consequences.
Cortisol,
stress than television.
So I'd like to move on now to generosity. And there have been some really remarkable studies over the last few years looking at how people who are unusually altruistic have differences in their brain. And one of the most important studies was published in 2014 on what is called by these scientists extraordinary altruists. And the way they specifically selected these individuals is they all donated a kidney to an unrelated individual. So they were selected from all over North America, and they were brought to a laboratory to be studied. And they studied their brain. And one of the remarkable things is it turns out the altruists have larger amygdalas. Physically larger. Now, the distributions overlap. You can see the distributions on the right, but on average, the altruists have larger amygdalas. And the hypothesis that was entertained is these are individuals who can resonate with others' suffering and act on that basis more easily than others.
So there's a sort of this question of causality. Are these individuals so extraordinary altruists because they happen to have a larger amygdala, or because they have larger amygdala, their amygdala has been enlarged because of their altruistic activity.
Yeah. Your Holiness, that's a wonderful question. We are interested in the same question. From this experiment, we cannot tell. My own conjecture is it's probably some of both. But what we're doing now, Your Holiness, is we're embarking upon a large study where we've actually put babies at 1 month of age in the scanner. And we could do that pretty easily with babies because they sleep. So we put them in the scanner while they're sleeping, and we can measure the size of their amygdala very easily when they're asleep, starting very early in life. So then we will be able to follow them over the course of their life. This will be a study that we're beginning now that will continue way beyond my time on this planet. We will be able to track to see if these differences predict whether individuals become more altruistic or whether engaging in altruism actually enlarges the amygdala. But I suspect it's some of each. So Matthew La,
the question his audience was asking is that would you also imagine the possibility of having some kind of chemical like medication substances that could increase the size of amygdala?
Your Holiness, I'm skeptical of that because we know that that these circuits are bathed in thousands of molecules. And so I don't think there's going to be a single magic bullet that will be able to change the chemistry in any simple way. I think it's going to be much more complicated. So Matula showed some wonderful videos of people acting. And clearly they acted so quickly because in the case of the pushing the car out of the way of the train or saving another person on the subway, it required acting instantaneously. Too quickly to really think about it. There's a study which was recently published of individuals risking their life without a second thought. Really quite extraordinary. And I'll give you two case histories. Christine Marty, a 21-year-old college student, rescued a drowning 69-year-old trapped in a car during a flash flood and simply said, "I was thankful I was able to act and not think about it." Then another case, Darren Starnes, a 70-year-old man, climbed into a burning vehicle to rescue a 48-year-old woman trapped inside a car after an accident and stated, "I just did what I felt like I needed to do. You don't think about someone making that big a deal out of it." So these are cases where individuals acted extremely quickly prior to extensive analysis. And there are, in the U.S., there is an award given. The Carnegie Hero Award is given to individuals who have done these dramatic altruistic acts. And they rated the extent to which their act was intuitive or was deliberative after thinking. And on the top, you can see the left-hand side is the most intuitive. The vast majority of Carnegie Hero recipients rated their acts as highly intuitive in the absence of thinking. So this is something that just occurred spontaneously to them without extensive analysis. Now, it's not to say that analysis is not important, and there are certainly certain kinds of altruistic behavior where analysis is important. And I'd like to just share one finding from such a study. This may be a little hard to see, and I apologize for the small letters, but this is a task where participants are given an economic choice to make. So they can choose to receive either, in the first case, 10-10, thank you, because I can't read it from here. So in the first case, say 1,000 points, which translate into dollars, versus the other recipient getting 190. And in the second case, a person can get 730 and the other individual
470.
So if the person is selfish, they would choose the first one because they maximize their gain and the other person gets very little. But if they're more altruistic, they get a little less for themselves. Instead of getting approximately 1,000, they get approximately 700, but the other recipient benefits, gets more money. And so the question here is there anything in the brain that predicts more altruistic behavior on this kind of standard economic decision-making task? And it turns out there's an area of the brain which is identified on the left, and this is called the temporoparietal junction, otherwise known as the TPJ. And this is an area that has been shown in many, many studies to be very important for perspective taking, taking the perspective of another. And it's a cognitive appraisal where you put yourself in the shoes of another person. And what this finding suggests is that people who have larger TPJs, whose the physical structure is actually larger, they behave more altruistically on this task.
Larry. So would you say that those individuals, you know, talking about the early examples, like Matthew's video, who act instantaneously to save someone, rushing, would you say that these people are in their own normal everyday life more kind of altruistic, more compassionate?
There is evidence to suggest they are, yes.
So it's not something that just happened accidentally,
no,
on the moment, because they had that kind of personality.
That's right. There's other evidence from these studies to suggest that in everyday interactions, they are more altruistic.
You know, Francisco wrote a book on ethics, and he said that when we cannot have time to deliberate, to think a lot, should I do this or should I do that, and we have to decide very fast, it's actually the expression of what you are inside. The overall sort of way of being, and that's why it's so important to cultivate. So there's a Canadian philosopher called Charles Taylor that ethics is not only what is good to do, but what is good to be. Because if you are basically good human beings, when the occasion comes, then the way you will react would be for others. So that shows that. There is a choice, but it's so fast because you don't have to hesitate. Why should you, you know, hesitate?
Thank you.
Now,
So another constituent of well-being, Your Holiness, that I mentioned that's been studied is attention. And to paraphrase the conclusion of a study that was published a number of years ago, the scientist said, a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. So, one of the
challenges...
So one of the challenges in this area of research is how can we measure this quality of wandering mind or more focused mind? And one of the ways that we've devised to do this in a very simple way is if you ask a person to press a button with each breath cycle, each time they inhale, they should press a button. And then on every ninth breath or every 13th breath, they press a second button.
Let it.
So when a person is asked to press with each breath cycle, individuals can do that almost perfectly. We've studied that in the laboratory with objective measures of their breathing. They do it almost perfectly. But when you ask them to press the second button every ninth breath or every 13th breath, they begin to make mistakes. Most people that we test who have not trained their mind because their minds wander. And it turns out that we can take advantage of that to measure mind wandering in this way or more focused attention. And so one of the questions that we asked, and I'll... going to skip some data here to really go to the most important finding. People who are better at monitoring their own breathing in this way report themselves to be happier. And so this is another confirmation that individuals whose minds wander more report themselves to be less happy, and on other measures we can show that they have less equanimity, they're more distracted, particularly by emotional cues, and we also find that individuals who've engaged in mind training, who've practiced meditation, do better on this kind of task. So I'm going to skip all the data and just go to the last point. There is a part of the brain which is connected to the amygdala called the hippocampus. And it's a part that's particularly involved in certain kinds of memory. It also is involved in certain kinds of emotion regulation. And it exhibits a property which is very distinctive, and not all other parts of the brain exhibit this property, but it's definitely exhibited by the hippocampus. And that is, it shows a certain kind of plasticity which involves the growth of new neurons that we call neurogenesis. Many other parts of the brain don't have that property, and it's controversial as to whether other parts of the brain have that property, but the fact that the hippocampus has it is not controversial. That is an established fact in modern neuroscience, that the hippocampus exhibits.
You're talking about neurogenesis?
Yes, neurogenesis.
So, the neuron savake juba. Kurang cepat plasticity kuntuane, tanda di hippocampus nalulia neuron sahaja kiki juga dili ya coba yomaris, tanda lebih cahaya sendal ya, ya neuron sahaja kiki tuh juga dah metin, tanda coba ciri, tanda hippocampus ke, itu mungkin lebih kejur lebih cik di, dili ya neuron sahaja kiki dicahaya juga cintan, dili coba yomaris.
And the hippocampus is also involved
in quality. Am I right in understanding that there is no dispute on the phenomenon of neurogenesis insofar as hippocampus is concerned, but in other areas of the brain, it's still a matter of debate?
Correct. It's still somewhat controversial. Yeah. But in hippocampus, it's clear. The hippocampus is involved in qualities like resilience, and in the ability to regulate our emotions. One of the things that we've learned from recent neuroscientific studies is that, and this is in terms of what's been studied, the most effective non-pharmacological way to induce increased plasticity and to grow new neurons in the hippocampus is through aerobic exercise.
Can you describe aerobic exercise, Richie? Mm-hmm. You want to describe? Aerobic exercise, hippocampus, neuron, aerobic.
So that is a way to increase neurogenesis and increase plasticity in the hippocampus. However, plasticity in and of itself is not necessarily good or bad, not necessarily virtuous or non-virtuous. If we increase plasticity and at the same time fill our mind with unwholesome thoughts, that can actually have negative consequences. But if we increase plasticity and fill our mind with wholesome thoughts, that may be a synergistic interaction. So, So, Your Holiness, this has led me to wonder whether there is a possibility of contemplative aerobics. And I think Your Holiness actually has discovered this for yourself.
I
So I was deeply moved by seeing this picture, and I had a conversation with you once, Your Holiness, where you were describing to me how you do daily exercise and at the same time recite specific mantra. And to me, this was the perfect blend of stimulating neuroplasticity, increasing neurogenesis in your hippocampus, and at the same time filling your mind with wholesome thoughts.
And now he's using cycle more because the treadmill is more impactful.
Some of my
for
friends
knees.
Said, you see, that is very bad for knees. I don't.
Well, the important thing is to exercise. Yes. So that is really all I wanted to share. And into, I think, this area of contemplative aerobics, I actually introduce with great seriousness because I think that it is something really important, and I invite the monastic community to consider the utility of combining physical exercise with mind training in a way that may be very beneficial for the brain.
Let it in. So, for example, in the debating courtyard, there is a kind of this contemplative exercise because there's a lot of physical activity and jumping and moving around. Especially when the debate exchanges get very heated, the physical actions are even more extreme. Yeah.
Good. So, Richie, thank you. I think it'd be great to give you a hand.
Thank you.
So it's really been a powerful morning of presenting the evidence, both from the point of view of society and the planet, and also in terms of well-being for individuals, of the power of compassion and altruism. And I wonder, Your Holiness, if you'd like to reflect for a few moments on this before we enter our dialogue.
Nothing. Other than expressing my admiration, and also making the statement, yes, exactly as you said. Just to affirm what you said, nothing specific. Yeah.
Wonderful. So now is the time for us to open up the conversation between the scientists and philosophers here. And I'd like to field any questions that you have for Mathieu and Richie. Comments, perspectives.
You want to use this?
John.
So one question I have for you, Richie, is something that we've discussed a little bit, but not too much so far, is whether this concept, this construct of well-being itself is has cultural variations. So, for example, we know that there in some cultures value some types of affective states over other cultures. Americans, for example, tend to value much more aroused states, whereas, let's say, persons in Japan tend to value much less aroused states. Or if they say what's their sense of happiness, in America, happiness can be very sort of bright and shiny, and in Japan it tends to be much more even-tempered in the way it's evaluated. So similarly, are there variations around well-being, or is this scale not really examining those questions? Another way of putting it is the same kind of well-being equally valued everywhere?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question. Yeah, it's a very important question. It's been examined to some extent in the psychological literature. This particular scale has been used now in about somewhere around 15 different cultures. It's been translated into many different languages. The scale has a number of different dimensions, including purpose in life, relations with others, self-acceptance. And it also is a scale which does not correlate that highly with scales of happiness that are the kind of measures that you're talking about,
like
where
the Diener scale.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so there's a major psychological literature on this. But I think it's still an empirical question. And the correlates of this scale are somewhat different in different cultures. So there's an extensive series of studies going on now in Japan with this scale. And the correlates of the scale are not identical in Japan as they are in the U.S. And so I think there are going to be some interesting variations. And so I think it's important that we be open-minded about what the nature of well-being might be. And in some sense, using this term we use it as a kind of placeholder. It's one of the reasons also why, you know, in our own center, we talk about investigating healthy minds, where there's not a specific formula for what a healthy mind is. And it's something that's still very much under investigation, and also the idea that one size is not likely to fit all.
Wonderful. Thanks, Richie. Lara, I think you have a reflection.
Just as a follow-up question, with some of the questions, when I look at them, for example, saying, I'm very happy with the way things have gone in my life, or I'm satisfied. In some cultures, it's taboo to say that because you're courting disaster, or it means you're not trying hard enough because you could have achieved more. Or if you wake up in the morning and think this will be a good day, again, you're courting disaster. You don't display such hubris. Yeah. And so what I'm wondering is, in your conception of well-being, is it how aligned you are with the cultural ideas that are around you, so how well you fit into the model that your culture has set up for you? Or do you think it's something that's actually going to differ? So if a or is it going to be something that actually differs across cultures? So if a culture says, don't be optimistic about your day, that's too hubristic, people in that culture will actually have less well-being. What do you think?
It's a wonderful question that you're asking, and I think the most honest answer is that we don't know at this point in time. I think it's something that still needs to be studied, and I suspect it's a nuanced answer, that it is in part fitting into the culture, but maybe not completely, that may be associated with more optimal levels of well-being. And I think it is a question which is going to need to be approached from many different angles.
Yeah, I'm thinking about David Aberle's perspective on the principle of the limited good, that if one person has too great an accumulation of good, that is subjective well-being or material goods, then that creates a sense of imbalance and competition and jealousy in the society. And so that good, it's important that good be equalized throughout the community and not be concentrated in one individual. So that would, I think, also have an effect on how well-being is perceived, not as just an individual sense of eudaimonia, but also is everyone sharing in that sensibility.
Just to emphasize on that, the French are famous to be grumpy. And if a French person replies that everything goes well, the thing is kind of stupid. But in fact, there was a very in-depth study at the satisfaction, are you happy at the workplace? And if you ask them bluntly, most of them in the street, they will say, of course, no, not enough salary on that. But in fact, in the end, when you really go in depth, 70% of French people said they were happy But if you ask them,
suicide rate.
So,
in big cities, higher. In a village area, less. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering,
that's
in America, those countryside people, I feel, you see, the villagers or countryside, you see, they have some kind of, the sense of community is stronger than workers in big city. So that, I think, some connection.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The sense of community, more trust. And that in deep inside, I think there's feeling, if I find some difficulties, this I can ask help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lonely person, mentally, although physically very crowded, but mentally a little bit lonely. So then sometimes, you see, difficult. That's the reason. So have you ever sort of test the people who spend in a village life and maybe very successful, but in big sort of
city slum,
busy life. Have you ever?
The closest that comes to it, Your Holiness, is there are two points to make. One is one of the things that I think you're implying is that social connectedness is so important, and there may be more social connectedness in the countryside. And certainly social connectedness is a very powerful contributor to well-being and also to physical health. The other really interesting element is that being in nature itself is beneficial. And there are studies that have been done where a person is asked to take a 10-minute walk in a city and a 10-minute walk in the countryside, and then the brain is measured. And you get very different patterns after 10 minutes of walking in nature versus 10 minutes walking in the city.
Yeah, I'm thinking about forest bathing in Japan, for example. Mathieu, and then...
No, there's just a short... There was a study in the hospital. People who have a room seeing trees, they need
room
less,
with a window,
less painkillers, and they recover faster.
So, Jay and then Carol.
We began this discussion by talking about perception a few days ago. And I was just noticing that between Vasu's discussion of actually perceiving minds and perceiving others as minds, and Mathieu's discussion, we've come back around to perception in a very interesting way.
Right.
And that is one of the important lessons of the kinds of remarks that Mathieu was making and the kinds of phenomena to which he draws our attention, reinforced by the phenomena to which Richie draws our attention, is that moral development and moral cultivation isn't necessarily the cultivation of actions or even the disposition to actions, but the cultivation of a kind of perception, a moral perception, and not just a different way of reacting to people or behaving with respect to people or to our environment or to ourselves, but a different way of seeing people, seeing our environment, seeing others and seeing ourselves. And I just think that one of the lessons we can take away from this and from a great deal of Buddhist ethics, and in particular Bodhicharya Avatara, is that when we cultivate ourselves morally, the first thing to cultivate isn't our actions, but rather our way of seeing. And so once again, we see the importance of thinking hard about perception and the plasticity of perception as a process.
Thank you, Jay. Wonderful. Carol.
I'd like to offer some data to the questions that you asked earlier about the role of culture and expectations and one's ability to achieve those expectations in relation to mental and physical health. Both in our own work and in the work of a number of anthropologists, it's been clearly established that your ability to achieve local norms of the good life, whatever those norms are, is associated with positive physical and mental health. That's a different question than asking the question about population differences in the kinds of cultures that individuals are living in and the relationship to their mental or physical ill health or well-being. And for that I can say, we do have one study in Nepal, which was a study of ex-child soldiers, which we did in 12 different locations across Nepal. And among many other things, this was a case-controlled study, boys and girls who had been taken into the war as child soldiers and those who had not, their case controls, who stayed in the villages. And we did find an effect of war, but and a negative experience in war, but the bigger effect was on the village level. There were huge locale differences before and after the war in the mental health of young people. And furthermore, we found that the proportion of Buddhists in the village, because Nepal is a mixture of Hindu and Buddhist, where the proportion of Buddhists was a third or greater, the impact of traumatic experience on child soldiers was vastly reduced compared to in villages where...
You say vastly reduced?
Reduced. So we have a community-level effect of the proportion of Buddhists in the population compared to where the proportion was low. So there's a, what we're saying is both... Oh.
That's very interesting.
So what we're saying is there are two kinds of effects. One is individual differences within a population and the extent to which practices or experiences can affect those individual differences. The other is population differences and how cultures can make a difference. And so if I may, I want to pose a question to Mathula, because you were saying, and I agree, I also work in evolutionary biology, and there is that elegant literature about the effects of groups of altruists. Every time altruists get together in simulations, altruism wins. So I'd like to ask you, in all the great experiences that you showed us of these cooperative projects, what are the kinds of conditions where we can foster altruists coming together and being affected?
How can we foster altruists coming together? Because the effects are greater when there's cooperation, but also there's a kind of mass effect.
Based on your experience.
Yeah.
Well, we need a microphone for...
Well, I think that's kind of obvious, so it's not much to add. I mean, to what the study, there was a similar study in Bangladesh, that communities were more cooperation, better social ties. They were feeling better, more resilient when after facing floods, less also traumatic problems. No, that's what you mean? No, I'm not sure. Anyway.
Carol, is that addressing your question?
We can discuss it. I'm not sure.
Yes. Thank you, Anda. This is the Michigi. Any altruism is not, but the Kadachi number of children.
Larry,
Sakis is the da, Sambush is one.
Rem.
That the Shizep and Tadanti, Major Nodrism, Tangazo,
Yes. So it's all necessary referring to the quote that you presented from Ayn Rand, which says she considers altruism to be evil.
Yes.
Due to lack of real meaning of altruism, I think basically, even biologically, is it too much to think oneself? Then automatically, distrust, or suspicion, and jealousy, all these negative emotions come. That's quite clear. Yeah. After all, we are social animals. So friendship, very important. Genuine friendship, I think, very difficult to develop. Both sides, too much self-centered attitude. I think very difficult. Isn't it? The other person also quite clever. You see, that person only think himself, herself. So then, that automatically remain a little bit distance. Trust. The other person really, taking care of me. And I also then, develop trust. That's the basis of friendship. So here, Jinju Gada. Jinju Dungi, Jinjiva, Tigu Rangdan Dolichu. Jinjan Dewa, Jinjiva, Tigu Shandan Dolichu. That is Sham the 200 Tisham. That is Sham the Dr. Shinji Dungada, Yanda Chow, Machana, Sanji Yudu Miru Kuana, Dawa Mesa. That is scientific.
So His Holiness's point is that Ayn Rand, someone like Ayn Rand, probably fully doesn't understand what the nature of altruism itself is. So probably has a distorted way of what altruism means and its role in human life. And His Holiness just quoted from Shantideva, where he summarizes, says that all the negative things that are in the world are consequences of extreme self-centeredness, and all the positive that are in the world are functions of altruistic perspective. And therefore, then he goes on to say that, therefore, if we do not learn to exchange ourselves with others, let alone attaining Buddhahood, even in this life in the world, you will have no joy, no happiness.
So here, I think important is, I
think some people, I think including that person, I think get the impression. Altruism means forget your own sort of
well-being.
That's totally wrong. And those people who have some kind of self-hatred sort of attitude, impossible to practice or to cultivate altruism.
Altruism.
So firstly, you yourself love, cherishing. Then other people, also like me, we are same sentient being, and particularly human being. I want happiness. I don't want suffering. Therefore, they also have same human being, same sentient being. They also have the desire to have some happy life, joyful life, do not want suffering. So on that level, altruism comes. And then these reasons, this is for best way to fulfill my sarvata kasoda, fulfill
well-being, long.
Bring joyfulness is altruism or take care of others. So I think the kasoda, very meaning of altruism or compassion, you completely forget yourself.
So I think
sometimes I jokingly was telling, I think those Buddhist sadhus.
So His Holiness's point is that someone like Ayn Rand, who is so opposed to altruism, probably understands altruism to involve or entail negating oneself, self-negation. Whereas in fact, without some kind of sense of concern for your own well-being, there is no basis to have the empathy to appreciate the need of others. Mm-hmm. So His Holiness was saying that he often says that the truly altruist bodhisattvas in fact have a very strong sense of the need for their self-care.
Thank you. Carol, did you want to? No. All right, Pavan.
Okay.
And then Lara. Then.
So I first wanted to thank Matthew and Richie for these amazing talks. I stand awed by your accomplishments and the implications of your work. So thank you very much for this amazing work. I have a small question for Matthew, which connects the work that you presented today with the work that we talked about the very first day, perception. So there, one of the big issues was this distinction between top-down and bottom-up processing. So when we think about the movement of societies towards a more altruistic state, do you think that one of these two styles of movement will be more significant? So is it going to be more of a bottom-up movement of people towards being more altruistic, or is there a role for some top-down guidance in this movement?
Just very briefly, I think one of the greatest revolutions of the 20th century was the NGOs revolution. Millions and millions of NGOs. You know, formerly in the 18th, 19th centuries, was the not the kings or the heads of state, but the merchants that traveled all over the world and connected the world. But now it's really the NGO, the civil society, that making huge difference. And they're sometimes underestimated. But, you know, it's very hard unless there's no politicians, of course, they look at next elections. Few statesmen look at next generations, very difficult, not very popular in opinion polls. So unless civil society, you know, say we care about environment or something, politicians won't move. So it is really the civil society I perceive as the key for the bottom-up. And then the top start moving.
It's wonderful, this kind of vision of a grassroots movement, which is very lateral, instead of corporate and political. Wonderful. I believe that, Lara, Kathy, are you going to follow on?
Kathy has been waiting here.
Kathy.
I actually want to follow that with a question about the individual training program that builds on Pavan's question. And I'm really blown away by what you've been able to accomplish in Nepal and Tibet, Matthew. And I have a question based for both of you based on Richie's question yesterday, which is, he talked about implicit procedural forms of learning, and one could say training, versus conceptual forms of training. And I'm thinking concretely in the work that you did in Nepal and Tibet, was there more of, you know, sort of signs and repetition of ideas, or was there more of sort of modeling of actions in a more implicit way? So implicit is where you're not really alerted to the fact that you're learning something, and it can be sort of at a perceptual sensory motor level, or it can be implicit ideas. Whereas conceptual is, we're going to train you in these specific ideas, and that's what we want you to get. Do you see the distinction? And I'm wondering what you think is more important in developing programs like the ones that you both have done.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's two ways works together. Aristotle said, virtue also comes through practicing virtue. So, of course, putting good in action will change you. At the same time, you have to change the outlook. I mean, if you start perceiving common humanities, then you will act differently. You know, I gave the example of those rescuers during the Second World War. There were many studies about who are those rescuers, because they were very wealthy, noble lady in Germany, from very poor shopkeeper with six kids in Holland, who save Jewish people, hiding them in their house at great dangers for years. So they tried to see what is a common factor. It was not religion, it was not something, it was They all said, those are human brothers and sisters, common humanity. So this worldview is also very important. So if you can inspire a different worldview, that changed the world. At the same time, if you don't put it into practice, what's the point? So pure heart, dirty hands.
And just to amplify on that, Your Holiness frequently talks about and talked about yesterday the extraordinary kindness from your own mother. And I think situations like that are occasions for implicit learning. It's not that the mother sits the child down and teaches the child kindness is very valuable in a declarative and explicit way. It's simply being kind. And through that sets an example. And I think that that is a very, very powerful form of learning. And I think the earlier it occurs, the more significant the consequences. And I think in some ways we can think of, and I'd be actually interested to hear Laura's comment about this comment, but we can think of compassion in many ways in the same way that that scientists think about language. We all come into the world with a biological propensity for language. But we need a normal linguistic community for that innate seed to be nurtured. And in the same way, I think it's true for kindness and compassion. We all come into the world with an innate propensity for this kind of innate basic goodness, but it requires a social field, if you will, an environment where these qualities are exemplified and nurtured in order for those seeds to flourish.
Thank you, Richie. I want to be, Jay, if I can intervene, I want to be sensitive to our 11:30 conclusion time. So I believe Susan has a comment she wants to make, and then we need to wrap up.
Yeah. Thank you, Roshi. Mathieu, Richie, thank you so much. This particular session resonates with my life's work and what is really, really important. And I just want to say that as I think about the vision of mind and life, I really want us to be bringing this conversation, this work, very much into our work going forward. So I just want to say that and thank you for your work.
Thank you, Susan. So I think we're going to conclude the session now, unless there are last words from His Holiness.
Nothing specific.
Thank you, everybody, so much.